Okay, great.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I know it's the end of a long day and the weather is gorgeous, so I appreciate you all spending this session here with us. First of all, I have no disclosures to, no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to be presenting on a project that I've been coordinating at Lurie Children's Hospital called Life Skills, which is a group-based HIV prevention intervention that was designed by and for young transgender women. And it's currently being tested as a randomized control trial in Chicago and in Boston. So just a little bit of background, as you may already know, young trans women are at high risk of HIV infection, with some studies indicating that 20% of young trans women are HIV positive, and other studies of trans women of all ages indicating HIV prevalence as high as 30%. And yet, to date, no evidence-based HIV prevention interventions exist, to my knowledge, for this population. And so we are testing this intervention, which addresses not only sexual risk, but also the many risk factors related to social and economic marginalization among this community. So to give you an overview of where this presentation is headed, I'm going to start with some information about the study design and also the intervention itself. And then I'll share a little bit about our sample demographics, a little bit about our recruitment and retention strategies, and then primarily I'll be talking about some of the challenges, opportunities, and lessons that we learned from delivering this intervention and testing its efficacy. So a little bit about the study design, first of all. We enrolled 300 young trans women across the two sites, at the Fenway Institute in Boston and at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Eligibility included being assigned male at birth, but identifying now as trans feminine, a trans woman, somewhere on the M to F spectrum. It was kind of fluid. And also people needed to be between the ages of 16 and 29. They had to speak English because that was the language that the intervention was delivered in. And they also needed to self-report a sexual risk behavior in the last 4 months. So the recruitment occurred everywhere and anywhere that you can imagine, at community events and spaces, at bars and at parties, on the street. One of our staff one time was driving down the street and saw someone on the other side of the street and pulled a U-turn to drive down the street and find her and recruit her for the study. So really our staff were amazing rock stars at recruiting a very, very difficult to recruit population, which I will talk a little bit more about. And I'd be happy to talk more about our particular recruitment strategies later if anyone wants to hear more about that. So the study design itself, it is a three-arm randomized control trial intervention, which is the Life Skills program, is one arm. There's an attention control arm, which was a cooking class focused on nutrition, and then the standard of care, which is testing only. The participants completed a battery of measures and HIV and STI testing, both at baseline as well as at 4, 8, and 12-month follow-up visits post-randomization. And of course, participants received stipends as compensation for their time and travel. So we screened 486 participants across the two sites. Of those, 420 were eligible, and the most frequent reason that people were not eligible was based on their prior sexual history. We enrolled 300 and randomized 230, and then our retention numbers are in the high 80s, which is really pretty great, especially for this, this community. And I think that as you can see, we kind of lost some people along the way, and I think that of course, is related to some of the challenges I'm going to talk about in terms of recruitment and retention. But the fact that we were able to retain that many people, yeah, I think it really speaks to once people got in the door and they met the staff and they participated in the randomization visit too, which included dinner and a time for people to kind of hang out and get to know each other, I think that people really felt comfortable, kind of built rapport with staff and with other participants, and then we had a relatively easy time of getting them back in after that. So the intervention design, like I said, the intervention was designed by trans women in Chicago who wrote the curriculum in 2008, And it was initially tested as a single-arm pilot in Chicago. And after that, we received funding from the NIMH for this two-city randomized control trial. Some of the theoretical frameworks that the intervention was based on, the Bronfenbrenner Ecological Systems Model. Any other social workers in the room? Anyway, okay, yes, you know. Yes, we're all about the Ecological Systems Model. So this is kind of the person and environment approach, which understands that individuals are not just behaving kind of their own volition, but also are influenced by all these other factors, by their peers, by their family, by systems, by institutions, by cultural norms, so kind of radiating out from the individual. And also the information motivation behavioral model, which is very common in HIV prevention interventions, understanding that people need not just information, but also tools and strategies and a chance to kind of practice the information that they're learning in the intervention. And community empowerment, again, of course, the intervention itself came from the community and has always been a primary focus of our intervention delivery, as well as thinking about next steps for the intervention. And so in terms of what the intervention actually looked like, it was delivered over 6 sessions over 3 weeks, so 2 sessions per week, and each of the sessions lasted about 2.5 hours, co-facilitated by trans women on staff. And like I said, included a number of opportunities for people to practice the skills that they were learning through role plays, through games, or art projects to make it a dynamic experience. These are the titles of each of the 6 sessions to give you an idea of the information that was in each of those sessions. And then this kind of overwhelming to look at picture is of the targets of intervention for each of the sessions. So as you can see, unprotected sex, needle sharing were at the center and were certainly important behaviors that the intervention was addressing, but also all of these other things depicted in this outer circle were also important and in some ways are of more interest to the young trans women that participated in the intervention than talking about unprotected sex or needle sharing. So that some of these other things are kind of the hook into which we can start these conversations. This next slide gives you an idea of the demographics of our sample. So like I said, the participants were between ages 16 and 29, with a mean age of 23 years old. Our sample was predominantly women of color, predominantly Black and African American women. And half of our participants had experienced homelessness in their lifetimes. Over half had ever been arrested by the police. About a third had ever been in jail or juvenile detention. And half had ever engaged in sex work, and about 22% of our sample is HIV positive, and that includes 3% who tested positive as part of the baseline survey. So now I'm going to move on to talking about some of the lessons learned from this process. And I should say too that we've just finished enrollment, so we are beginning to start to look at some of the outcomes. I won't be talking about those today. Instead, I'm talking more about the actual process of designing, delivering this intervention, and evaluating it, which I think in a study like this, especially among this community, the process is equally as important as the outcomes. And so that's kind of a little bit of what I'm sharing today. So we convened these feedback sessions with staff in Boston and Chicago to ask about what are the lessons that we've learned, what have been the challenges and opportunities of the study so far. And the transgender women who are members of our staff in particular provided some information about their experiences and that dual role as both members of the community and staff on the study. We combined the notes from the feedback groups into one document and then shared it across the two sites. And then we conducted thematic analysis of some of the themes that emerged. So unsurprising to anyone who has done this type of research or this type of practice before, structural factors were huge and were a large barrier to enrollment and retention. Like I said, about half of our participants have engaged in sex work, and that prevented them sometimes from attending, especially group sessions. Knowing that the amount of money that they would get for participating in a group was much lower than what they could make if they got a call from a client and they wanted to be available, you know, if they should get a call. Or also sometimes people came to group and then got a call and then had to leave in the middle of group. So we explored with offering groups at different times of day, but it didn't really seem like the time of day made that much difference in terms of when people were getting called to work. So that was definitely one barrier for us. Incarceration was another large issue, especially with retention. A number of our participants became incarcerated over the year that we were following up with them, and we couldn't get them in for their follow-up visits. And then also other criminal legal system involvement. We had a number of participants in our last group in Chicago who were on house arrest, and we thought that they thought initially that they would still be able to participate, and then when the groups came, their parole officers kind of put up some unforeseen barriers to their participation, and they weren't able to make it. So that was another huge barrier to participation. Across both of the, in both cities, participants are really spread out, especially in Boston. People are living not just in Boston, but in the surrounding towns. And so getting to the, especially the group sessions twice a week, is a challenge for people. And we anticipated that and provided travel assistance to people. But what I think we didn't anticipate is that a lot of people travel together for safety. As young trans women, especially trans women of color, it's important to travel with a buddy. So people would enroll in the group together, come to the group session together, and then be randomized, one to a group and then one to the standard of care. And then you know, that person doesn't need to come back to the group and the other person does. And that really impacted some of our retention in the group sessions. And then, of course, homelessness and housing instability also is a barrier, both to recruitment and retention. But we also found that some of our participants experiencing homelessness were more engaged in the intervention. We think because they didn't have a lot of other competing activities, and also because the information just seemed especially relevant for their lives and kind of the experiences that they were going through. So again, speaking to that point about who the intervention is most relevant for, we found that young trans women who are a little bit further along in their transition seem to perceive the material as less relevant. They just thought, why do I need this? I'm already on hormones. It's just not for me. And so we did sometimes try to engage them as, you know, you can come and share your experiences with other people, but that didn't always work. Some of our staff who had worked on the pilot study shared that from when they were recruiting people a couple years ago to now, a lot of young women were saying, I have a job, I'm in school, I don't have time for this, it's just not a priority for me, which is great. I mean, it's great if people are have these other things going on and don't have time to participate in an intervention. So that was both kind of a, you know, an issue for us, but also ultimately really awesome. And the participants really kind of related more to facilitators who shared their racial and ethnic background as well as their gender presentation, kind of especially their gender presentation. So for young women who had a more, had like a less binary gender presentation or a more androgynous presentation, they didn't necessarily feel that comfortable in the group either. So even though the staff really made an effort to be very inclusive in their language and how they talked about different experiences and issues, some women just still felt, again, that the group just wasn't relevant to their lives. And then a positive, the staff have talked a lot about how they really feel like they were providing an important alternative to other information that trans women were getting from their peers or from their mentors, that they were really providing kind of a balanced perspective to information about like getting hormones on the street or pumping or other issues that they felt like women just were not getting kind of the pros and the cons or some of the harms and the benefits, and that they were providing a really valuable and needed source of information that people couldn't get elsewhere. So a big thing that came up a lot in our feedback sessions was related to trust. So we, in particular, we found it really important for building trust among community stakeholders, especially in Boston, where this intervention hadn't been delivered before and programs like this didn't really exist. But the participants also had a big, a large amount of distrust about the study process in general. So especially related to screening determinations and randomization. When people screened ineligible or when they were told you are not gonna, you're randomly assigned to not participate in a group, they were understandably confused and felt excluded. And that, despite all of our attempts to explain to them the research process, and despite that being part of the consent process, there was still a lot of confusion and disappointment related to that. And I think that's one of the takeaway points that's really important for us to think about delivering an intervention with people who are already excluded from services and programs, already feel isolated. So that's, I think that's an important thing, and I'd love to talk more about that. Some of this, again, is what you kind of what you would expect, and I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to move to this one. So again, for the trans woman who worked on staff, being a member of the community was challenging. A lot of people didn't have experience working in social service settings prior and didn't have the background in kind of dealing with participants who were experiencing trauma, as well as that kind of mirroring some of their own experiences of trauma. Was really challenging. So we found it important to provide clinical supervision for staff so that they would have an opportunity to kind of talk about those experiences and come up with some strategies. In conclusion, of course, we need more interventions. This intervention we found worked especially well for women experiencing homelessness. At least that's what we've heard so far. But there's a need for more interventions. That would tailor to other women. And of course, you know, balancing the pros and cons of this type of research, of a randomized control trial, with a community that's often been excluded from programs and services, we think is really important. And then, I mean, it's a no-brainer, but involving members of the community in this type of research, especially as we think about scaling up an intervention that originally came from the community, thinking about how to continue to not just engage members of the community, but continue to have them feel like they have ownership over the intervention as well as some of the products of research. Thank you to our Life Skills participants who have dedicated so much of their time to this project, and to all of our staff, including our recruiters and facilitators, and to the NIMH. Thank you.